This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Across the state yesterday, towns held their annual meetings to make decisions about budgets, schools, and issues facing their local communities. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to wrap up the results from Town Meeting Day. We're going to start off looking at the fate of municipal budgets and some other key local government issues with Karen Horn, who's the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great today. Must have been a very busy day for you yesterday as you look at the results from Town Meeting Day all across Vermont. What are some of the most significant trends and results that you see?
Well, it was a fascinating day, as it always is. We had most town budgets and actually most school budgets pass. So that was a good thing. They went down in a few places, but really not very many. We had 11 towns at our last count that looked at making statements about being welcoming communities or wanting to be sanctuary communities. There were a number of those kinds of motions that were amended on the floor to be more about welcoming and non-discriminating versus anything that might have legal consequences. There were also 11 municipalities, by my count, that had some kind of resolution regarding presidential candidates needing to release tax returns in order to qualify for being on the primary ballot. And then the town of Charlotte actually adopted a resolution that called on the Congress to investigate whether sufficient grounds exist for impeachment of the president. All of those are really more advisory opinion poll kinds of questions. They're not, in fact, business that's proper before the town. Especially in the and towns, well, with the exception, I would say, of these sanctuaries, community kinds of questions. But the other kinds of questions, the town doesn't have any authority, clearly, to do anything about those issues. So it's more of a advisory vote.
Karen, how do you
feel about
that?
And then there were actually 10 proposals involving 57 districts and 11 supervisory unions around school consolidation. And I don't have the result of how all of those turned out yet, but that's a pretty considerable number of towns around the state that voted on consolidation yesterday or the day before.
Karen, I wanted to ask you how you felt about these national advisory questions coming up at town meeting. Some people think it's inappropriate. Other people think it draws people to town meeting. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that it definitely does draw some people to town meeting. And I think also it sometimes draws new people who haven't been to town meeting yet. My town meeting is in Moortown, and we had one person there who was there for the first time at a town meeting, and she said, "I'm coming back. I really like this. I'm going to do it again." So that's all to the good of town meeting. I think if there are questions that don't take up a considerable amount of time or take up time away from the regular business of the meeting, we've been doing this for a long time. We talked about nuclear proliferation. We've talked about all kinds of things at town meeting over the years. So, like it or not, it is a part of town meeting.
And Karen, slowly over the years, we see more and more towns choosing to make big money decisions like their school budgets using the Australian ballot so more people can come and vote on these issues really at any point during the course of the day. Do you think town meeting is in any kind of jeopardy in Vermont?
I don't think that it is in jeopardy, and perhaps part of that is wishful thinking. I think that town meeting is really a demonstration of democracy to the world, not just to the other states in this country, but we do have a very consistent numbers, although they might be low, that turn out for town meeting. There are young people that come and get involved in town meeting every year. Interestingly, we had in Wilmington this year, they had a proposal to move to Australian ballot from floor discussion, and that was actually turned down. In Killington, there was a motion to, or a ballot item to go back to voting from the floor, and they voted that down. So in Killington, they're going to retain the Australian ballot form of voting. And a lot of towns have mixed. You know, they'll elect officers via Australian ballot, and they'll do the town budget via Australian ballot, but they'll do other items from the floor.
Karen Horn, Public Policy Director at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
So let's swing down to Rutland County and talk with VPR's Nina Keck. Hi, Nina. Hopefully we'll have Nina in just a moment.
I'm still there, Bob. Hey there.
Oh, there you are. That's good to have you here. Boy, there's a lot of news down in Rutland yesterday, Nina. Starting off with the race for mayor, incumbent Chris Lewis was seeking his sixth term. He had a number of competitors. Tell us about this race.
Well, it was an exciting one with quite a surprising finish. There were four candidates, Michael Coppinger, Cam Johnston, and the winner, David Allaire, all up against the incumbent, Chris Lewis. And David Allaire won a really amazing political upset with 52% of the vote. And it was interesting watching the campaign because Allaire was short on specifics during the months leading up to the race, but he stressed a message of trust and transparency that I think really resonated with voters. And that was in response to the anger that's been festering in Rutland over the way outgoing Mayor Lewis handled refugee resettlement. Many said Lewis did that in secret without input from the Board of Aldermen or local voters. And so Allaire's message of being more out in the open with policy, I think, resonated. Also, another issue that was big was anger over how best to restructure the city's fire department. That came to play in the race, and David Allaire won a very coveted endorsement from the City Firefighters Union, which I think was also crucial for him in this win. And last night, I spoke to David Allaire after hearing about his victory, and he talked about other issues that he felt were important in the race.
And I was also talking about jobs, economic development. I mean, that is huge here. You know, we're an economically depressed area. If you walk around downtown, there's a lot of empty storefronts. And, you know, there's no magic bullet to change that. But you have to focus on that. You have to put your priorities in straight and get to work on those.
And David Allaire will get to work when he takes over as mayor on March 15th.
So, Nina, there's no doubt in your mind that the whole refugee question was a major issue in the race in terms of trust and transparency?
It really was, Bob. And I was talking to outgoing Mayor Chris Lewis about that this morning, and he was saying as much as he wanted to believe that the election would be about other issues, you know, during the mayoral debates and the forums, they talked about infrastructure, and they talked about the opiate crisis, and they talked about crime rates and how to lure more businesses and create job growth and deal with Rutland's declining population. Lewis admitted that, in hindsight, refugee resettlement really was the issue that carried the day. And I asked him point blank, you know, did he regret his decision to bring up resettlement? And this is what he had to say.
If refugee resettlement cost me my job, so be it. I'm proud of that. If that's what cost me my job, bringing those nine people here, bringing those five children here to rebuild their lives, good. That's fine.
And I talked to outgoing Mayor Lewis this morning about what his future plans were, and he kind of rolled his eyes and said, you know, I really even haven't had a chance to think about that. I was planning on being in the city for another 2 years as mayor, so I think he's still catching his breath.
Nina, Rutland also had 17 people running for the city's Board of Aldermen. They were running for six seats on the board. What were the key issues in those races, and how did things turn out?
Yeah, what a whopping turnout, huh? It wasn't a record, but it sure was close. I think, again, the whole refugee resettlement issue trickled down to exciting people on both sides of the issue to run for office. You had some of the top vote-getters, Tom DePoy, an incumbent, and Timothy Cook, one of the founders of Rutland First, a very vocal opponent of resettlement, who ran for office again and got a lot of votes. You also had people who were very pro-refugee and newcomers to city government that won office. So let me just read down the list of the six folks that won. As I mentioned, Thomas DePoy, Lisa Ryan will also be a new member of the Board of Aldermen, Timothy Cook, Melinda Humphrey, Christopher Attori, an incumbent, and Rebecca Mattis, a newcomer. So a lot of action, and I think, again, people that I spoke to who were running for office just said they got a taste of community activism when they went to various meetings and they wanted to take the next step and run for office. So I think that's a win-win for Rutland.
VPR's Nina Keck, many thanks for your report.
You bet, Bob. Good talking with you.
Just ahead in this hour, we're going to be looking at school budgets and some very close votes on school district mergers. But first, let's go to Burlington, where voters had a contentious city council race, a massive school bond vote, and a couple of referendums to vote on. Burlington Free Press reporter Jess Allo joins us from their newsroom to explain how these issues were decided. Hi, Jess.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great for you to have you on the program. Well, as I mentioned, there were some contested city council races. A lot of attention on that race featuring incumbent Jane Nodell. She's a progressive with Democratic support. She was challenged by a candidate from the left. How did this turn out?
It came down. It came really close. It ended up she won by 81 votes, and it really came down to become very close. She was challenged by Janice Grill, who, like you said, was an independent candidate who really did come at her from the left.
And were you surprised by those results?
No, I wasn't surprised that it. I did expect it to be close. Janice Grill campaigned very hard in the central district, was wards 2 and 3, and those were the areas that had voted against the mall redevelopment in November. Janice Grill was a leading voice against that development, and one of the issues that she had made an issue in this election was the mall redevelopment. And so, you know, that kind of came back up again. But as Jane said last night, a lot of people who, she said that a lot of people who voted against the mall redevelopment at the Burlington Town Center voted for her. So Jane Nodell said that she was able to reclaim some of those votes.
Now, school board members were seeking a roughly 5% increase in spending. How did the budget do?
Budget passed. The budget passed in the new North End. The new North Enders voted against it, which is not unexpected. That happens a lot. But in the rest of the city, it got a lot of support in the rest of the city, and enough to get it passed. So you saw some really wide vote margins in the rest of the city. You saw a lot of support for it. So I think outside of the new North End, there was so much support for the budget that it was enough to get it passed.
Schools were also seeking a $19 million bond to help upgrade many of Burlington's 9 public schools. Much debate over that, and how did it turn out?
That passed with even wider margins than the school budget did. Every ward passed it. Every ward supported it. Even in the New North End, they supported it, although you didn't see the same wide margins in the New North End that you saw in the rest of the city. You know, you saw support in some wards of 80-20 splits. In the North End, you saw, 60-40. So not the same wide margins, but a lot of support for it. And I think there's a sense that it's time to upgrade some of these schools. You can sort of see them, you sort of see the need for that, that there really needs to be a lot of capital improvement, and it's time.
And Jess, Burlington voters also had a chance to voice their opinion on a plan to raise the state minimum wage to $15 an hour. How did that do?
That did really well. I think overwhelmingly, Burlington voters said, yes, let's do this. We want to do it, though it's hard to say if that same support would be translated if this was anything other than an advisory question. Obviously this is an advisory question to say that we think this should be done. This doesn't actually change anything. There's no policy change that goes into place. The outlook of the bills in Montpelier is looking increasingly unlikely that there'll be anything passed this session in Montpelier. However, the people behind, the organizers behind this advisory question were hoping that a strong showing of support would give legislators a push. And if they wanted a strong showing of support, they certainly did get that.
Jess Allow from the Burlington Free Press, many thanks for your report today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And let's go to our callers and talk to Bill in Jericho. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Glad to be here.
What's on your mind today? What can you tell us about?
Well, I was thinking of the presidential financial transparency resolution and the sanctuary city resolutions. There are over 20 towns, it seems, that did these. And I think it's a great call out to America and to Washington, D.C., that Vermont cares about these issues, and we have a voice, and it's a moral and thoughtful voice.
Bill, many thanks for your phone call today. Coming up next, our school budget votes, a barometer for how people feel about their property taxes. We'll look at school budget votes just ahead on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition on VPR.
Podcasts. There are so many good ones to listen to right now, but not everyone totally gets how they work. So think of a person in your life who might enjoy them and then recommend a podcast you think they'd really love. If your friend needs a little help listening or subscribing, walk them through it. Once you're done, tell us what podcast you shared. Use the hashtag Trypod, TRYPod. Thanks for spreading the love.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at town meeting results from all across the state. Well, a lot of people were wondering how school budgets would fare across the state yesterday. It appears that roughly 18 budgets were defeated. And to put that number in perspective, the largest number of school budget rejections came in 2003 when 51 budgets were defeated by voters. It was about roughly 20% of all school budgets in the state. On the flip side, in 2011, only 3 budgets were rejected by voters. So with us now to discuss the fate of local school budgets is Nicole Mace, who's the executive director of the Vermont School Boards Association. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for being on the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So, Nicole, what's your general reaction to the results from yesterday?
Overall, I'd say communities in Vermont this year maintained their strong support for public schools. We saw generally the same number of budget defeats that we see year to year. Slightly higher this year than last year, but fewer defeats than we saw in 2014 and 2015. So it does not appear as though Vermonters responded to Governor Scott's call to solve our state's budget problems by rejecting school budgets.
What do you think the message that lawmakers in Montpelier should take away from these school budget votes yesterday?
Well, I think one message is that Vermonters continue to support their public schools and continue to place a lot of faith in their locally elected school boards to develop budgets that respond to the needs of students and taxpayers. And I think it's also important for our folks to recognize that concerns about the affordability of K-12 education are real and legitimate. And so we need to continue our focus on identifying opportunities to realize cost savings while ensuring we're maintaining our commitment to quality public education.
Nicole, I think that on average, school budgets were rising just over 2% across the state. How hard was it for many school boards to reach this threshold, given the increasing costs of health care and energy for many schools?
Well, I think certainly annual increases in health care and other costs that are built into collective bargaining agreements are, you know, costs that become difficult to manage in a single year. So to the extent you're in a collective bargaining agreement that extends into a budget year, you have fairly limited flexibility in terms of costs that comprise roughly 80% of a budget. Every school district in the state is negotiating right now, and health insurance is a big topic of those negotiations. So I think it's important that boards engage in those negotiations with an eye toward the call for greater affordability and identify opportunities to realize savings where they can be found.
Nicole, Governor Scott is still pushing his plan to increase funding for early education, higher education, and child care, and he argues that the state spends $1.6 billion a year on K-12 education, and he says there must be ways to save 5 or 10% of this money, and he often points to the PICUS report that came out a few years ago that said Vermont could save as much as $150 million by increasing its student-teacher ratios and reducing the number of students who've been recommended for special education services. And the report says these changes can be made with virtually no impact on the quality of education. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, first, I want to say that our association supports the governor's goals of making Vermont more affordable, strengthening the economy, and protecting vulnerable Vermonters. And there needs to be a plan in place in order to realize savings over time in a way that maintains our strong public education system. So we and our members look forward to working with the General Assembly through the remainder of this session and the governor to pursue options for cost containment that maintain our commitment to a strong and vibrant public education system and respect the important role that local officials play in the system. I think the way in which the governor's proposals came out this year with no prior engagement of local officials is problematic. There are opportunities to bend the cost curve in education. I think the results we saw on Act 46 votes yesterday point to the fact that local officials are willing to do the hard work to bend the cost curve, but it needs to be a work that's done in partnership.
Nicole Mace is the executive director of the Vermont School Boards Association. Many thanks for being on the program today, Nicole.
Thank you, Bob.
We did get this email from Scott Montpelier, who wrote us, "I think the overwhelming passage of school budgets is a repudiation of Governor Scott's plan for funding higher education and preschool on the backs of public schools." We turn now to VPR's Howard Weiss-Tissman, who's been closely following Act 46 mergers. Hey, Howard, great to have you on the program.
Hey there, Bob.
So tell us about the results from yesterday, Howard.
Well, there were 10 votes. There were 10 plans up for vote that covered about 58 towns. So it's really hard to sum them up because each plan was a little different. Some included some choice, some didn't. And so it's hard to say, kind of sum it all up in one swooping case. But what I will say is that 6 of the plans were supported. 4 of them were voted down, but 2 of the plans literally were voted down by a single vote. There were plans down in Rutland, and there were 2 plans that were linked together, and a single vote in Wells, which rejected that merger plan, meant that both were voted down. So if that one plan, one vote swung the other way, we would be looking at 8 of the 10 plans moving forward.
So how, explain to us how these merger votes work. In some cases, if one of the towns votes no, does the whole plan go down? And in other cases, if a town votes no, then the other towns go ahead without it?
Yeah, that's another instance where it's really hard to make one swooping statement about all the plans, because in some of the plans, every single town is what's called necessary. And if there are six towns, every one of them need to move forward. But in some of the plans, they have necessary towns and advisable towns. And so in Addison-Rutland, for instance, there are six towns, but some of them were advisory. And so four of the six towns in Addison-Rutland voted yes, two voted no. But the way that the plans were written, the Addison-Rutland merger plan was allowed to go forward, even though Orwell and Fairhaven voted no. And in that district, Benson, Castleton, Hubbardton, and West Haven approved the plan. So it's kind of hard to say between approved and necessary how the plans shook out.
Howard, school choice has been a big issue in some of these mergers. Did it play a role in yesterday's votes?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard to get into the heads of every voter, but when you look at the plans that failed and the plans that succeeded, I think it's hard to ignore the fact that school choice does continue to be a big issue for people. In Windham Northeast, the towns of Athens, Grafton, and Westminster, they would have lost their limited school choice, and all three of those towns voted down the plan in Windham Northeast, so that plan is going down. And likewise, there are two districts up in the Northeast Kingdom that cover about 18 towns in Caledonia and Essex counties, and those districts were able to have their towns retain their choice. And of the 18 towns, only one voted down. So up there in the Northeast Kingdom, you could say that the merger plans addressed the school choice issue and did it successfully, and the town supported that plan. So I think that the school choice issue does still play a role in how these merger plans are playing out. And if you look at the state, and if you look at the parts of the state that are still having problems putting these merger plans together, a lot of them have to do with school choice, where there's one town or two towns that are kind of stuck in the middle, and those two towns have choice, and it's hard for them to find other teams to play with, if you will.
So, Howard, as you tally up all the merger votes that have taken place on Act 46 this far, do you conclude that, for the most part, the process is proceeding pretty well, or is this tally somewhat skewed by the fact that the towns that went first were really ready to make those changes?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's, I think, one of the questions that lawmakers are grappling right now. As you know, the Senate Education Together is the Senate Education Committee is putting a bill together, and they're trying to figure out kind of just how much leeway to give towns that are struggling to get their plans together. And the idea is that this law is moving forward. Prior to Tuesday, about 50% of the kids in the state were already in districts that had their plans passed. With the plans that were passed yesterday, we're inching up to 60% or so. And so lawmakers are trying to decide between giving towns a little bit of freedom to experiment, but trying not to slow the process down. There's also a big question out there as far as what the Secretary of Education is going to do at the end of this process and what is going to happen to the towns that weren't able to get plans together. But those are some questions that no one can answer quite yet.
And one issue lawmakers are looking at is perhaps delaying some of the deadlines. How do you think that'll go over?
It's hard to say. I think that the legislators are really, you know, they're looking at the carrot and the stick, and they want to keep the deadline so people do continue moving forward. But one of the big incentives with those deadlines are these tax savings, and the legislators are trying to decide if they should extend some of those tax breaks for some of the towns that are having real troubles putting their plans together. And maybe if we give them another 6 months or 8 months or a year and keep those tax incentives on the table, maybe some of the more troublesome plans will come together. But at the same time, they don't want to kind of take their foot off the pedal, if you will, and let people think that this law might go away or that end game of the Secretary of Education making some of the harder decisions, that that's not still out there on the future.
And finally, Howard, the Senate Education Committee is also looking at a plan to curtail the power and authority of the State Board of Education. Does that factor into this Act 46 debate at all?
That's a good question. That more has to do with the independent school rule, but certainly the State Board of Education has a lot to do with these Act 46 merger plans. Before the Act 46 plans go before voters, the State Board has to approve them. So there could be an argument. There's been some interesting talk about there about curtailing their power. So it's a good question. I'm not sure. We'll have to see where that bill goes and just how much authority they do try to take away from the State Board.
VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Across the state yesterday, towns held their annual meetings to make decisions about budget, schools, and issues facing their local communities. Today on Vermont Edition, we're wrapping up the results from town meeting day, and you can tell us what happened in your town. Let's turn to Kate in Hinesburg. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. I had was reporting that there was a very good turnout. I've been to many town meetings over the last 20 years, and it certainly seemed very zestful, but there was a particular high point, excuse me, that I thought I'd report on. It was Article 14, and it was the language that produced a great deal of laughter. And can I read it for you? Should I read it for you?
If it's not too long.
No, I don't think so. And you can imagine, if you will, our town moderator struggling to read this out loud. Pursuant to 20 VSA Clause 3546, shall the voters authorize the select board to adopt an ordinance regulating domestic pets or wolf hybrids by an ordinance that diverges from the procedures in statute by allowing, among other things, the filing of complaints regarding dog bites or attacks by law enforcement officers, regardless of the location of the bite or attack.
Well, that's quite an ordinance.
The last part was what really had to be changed, the part about allowing them to file complaints regarding dog bites or attacks by law enforcement officers, regardless of the location of the bite or attack. And our police chief got up and immediately said, I didn't write that.
All right. Well, Kate, thanks very much for sharing that with us. Joining me now in our Montpelier studio, VPR reporter Amy Noyes and VPR's news director, John Dillon. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Hello, Bob.
You know, every town has a unique set of issues and items to vote on. We want to go through some of these items now with both of you. Let's start with two advisory votes that were taken up in a number of towns. The first was about presidential candidates and their tax returns. Here's some of the debate that took place in Jericho.
We want to know all of the financial dealings that the people who are running for the highest office in the land, we want to know what their financial dealings are.
And if the Ethics Committee doesn't desire to have taxes as a requirement for, you know, running for president, wouldn't they be the ones to ask, not Jericho Town Meeting? I'm not sure if it's really pertinent for us to argue this issue.
John, we heard that about a dozen towns took this up. And it got a fair amount of traction at local town meetings. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm just reflecting on the last call and how town meeting is so much sometimes a blend of the hyper-local and the national. And what we heard throughout the state town meeting night or town meeting day was an effort to inject Vermont citizens into some national debates. And obviously the President Trump has not disclosed his income tax returns. There's legislation in Vermont that would require a presidential candidate as a requirement to get on the ballot in Vermont to do so. And a number of towns, as you heard, debated in Jericho, considered that and supported it. Underhill did not, but it passed in Williston, Jericho, Bolton, Richmond, Worcester, East Montpelier and Marshfield. It's interesting because there's a real question about whether the state can actually do this or not, not to mention whether a town can do it. But the town is just supporting the state's effort to do it. There's a constitutional question of whether a state can dictate a requirement for a federal office seeker.
Amy, there was also a referendum taken up in a number of communities about making their towns a sanctuary city. Tell us about that and any kind of legal impact that that might have.
So that discussion looked very different depending on where you were. There were some towns, such as I believe Plainfield, that had a very long and involved article that passed. And other towns decided to edit it from the floor. Some towns like Morristown and Richmond came out with a pared-down inclusivity statement. So it really depended on where you were, what that looked like. But a lot of towns did discuss it.
Four central Vermont towns had votes on a development project called New Vistas, and they resoundingly sent a message opposing the idea. The New Vistas Foundation has been purchasing thousands of acres of property in Sharon, Stratford, Tunbridge, and Royalton to build what it calls a sustainable community for 15 to 20,000 people. Tunbridge resident John Blakeney was one of the few people who didn't oppose the New Vistas plan.
You know, change is going to happen. I don't want somebody telling me what I can and can't do with my land. I'm not going to even try to tell somebody else what they can or can't do with theirs.
And we're going to turn to Randy in Royalton, get his thoughts on this idea. Randy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Steve.
Okay, so what are your thoughts?
Well, I am a Royalton resident, and we had this on our town meeting morning, as well as the towns of Sharon and Stratford and Tunbridge. And resounding is a good word. Tunbridge was 164-4. So John Blakeney, who you had on just a second ago, he was one of the four. All the towns were similar in their numbers. This is a huge, huge development. He's talking 20,000 people on an area right now where there's a few farms and residential houses and forest land, top of a mountain. And he's considering, David Hall is considering putting these things all over the state. If you look at his website, it's pretty extensive about his plans for what's going to happen to our communities. And we feel very strongly this will destroy our community's structure fabric that we've been working on for hundreds of years here. So we're very frightened about his proposals, and our message yesterday to our own select board and planning commissions was very strong, and we want this to go to the state and to the governor and to them, everyone in the state, to know that this is a threat that that could affect everyone. It's a statewide issue, but we took care of it in our towns. Or at least, I know it's a non-binding resolution, but it was a strong statement, and I think our votes in our towns mean something.
Randy, thanks very much for your phone call. John, what do you think? What difference do these votes make, very strong votes?
Well, I think they make a difference in a couple of ways. For one, it's a message to David Hall, the person Randy mentioned, who is a Utah entrepreneur, engineer, who made a fortune there in drilling equipment, I believe, and has this vision for these planned developments, including one near Salt Lake. And he has said, you know, the people are against it. He's not going to force it, you know, on the community. So obviously these four towns are against it. So it makes a difference just in terms of public sentiment for him. And then if it goes through Act 250 and if these towns have town plans, presumably those plans could be amended or used in the Act 250 process to say that this scale of development doesn't conform with that town plan and therefore wouldn't be compatible with the Act 250 criteria.
Amy Wolcott in Montpelier passed a resolution honoring David Budbill. Why is he so fondly remembered in these towns?
Well, David called Wolcott home for a very long time, and at the end of his life, he lived in Montpelier. But he also considered Montpelier his home theater at the Lost Nation Theater. So he's really connected to both communities. And Montpelier was the first. They actually had an article on the ballot to named David the People's Poet of Vermont. And this came about because he was never named the Poet Laureate of the state in his lifetime, and many people feel that was an honor he should have had during his life. So this is a way to honor his very down-to-earth, very Vermont-y, Vermont-connecting poetry.
John, there were also some interesting incidents in the town of Plymouth. What the heck happened down there?
Well, it turns out that if you are running for office, you shouldn't be an election official in the town. And apparently that's what happened. There are two people who were doing that. And anyway, so all ballots were rendered void in Plymouth because two people there were running in contested races while they were also working at the polling station. The select board called the Secretary of State's office for advice and were told this could lead to a court challenge if you proceed. And so they decided to call off the election. And the Secretary of State's office is quite sensitive about this. They say they didn't – Jim Condos has emailed us and said, we didn't tell him not to do the election. We just told him it could be subject to court challenge. But with that proviso that they could not face a legal challenge and could have an election that was rendered moot, they decided to call it off. And they'll have to hold a new election.
A very unusual situation.
It is, and it kind of, you can see why that rule is in place, right? I'm sure politics are clean in Plymouth, but you don't want to have local people who are running for office actually managing the vote.
Let's talk to TJ, who's calling from Berkshire. Hey, TJ, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. Actually, regarding the Plymouth scenario, we had a similar scenario. Identical, in Berkshire. They were not contested offices. Only their name was on the ballot, but still they were there. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, TJ. We'll have to ask the Secretary of State about that. Amy, in Wilmington and Cabot, I believe residents had a debate about town meeting itself, whether to stop holding a traditional floor meeting and move to an Australian ballot instead. What was that debate like?
Well, it was different in each town. Wilmington was exactly as you said, and they decided that they were going to retain their traditional town meeting. In Cabot, voters were actually given three options, A, B, or C. A was to retain the traditional Tuesday town meeting, and that's what they chose. The other options were to have a Monday night meeting or a Saturday meeting, but it wasn't all Australian ballot. It was still floor meetings.
Well, and this comes up in many towns periodically over the years, and it's sort of, does town meeting work? People make the argument that it's if you are working that day, you can't show up and vote. Many towns have gone to a hybrid where some things are paper ballot, some things are done at the floor meeting. But we see sort of for some of these town meetings, 10-11% turnout, which isn't great. You see larger turnout with Australian ballot, but you don't get the benefit of a discussion.
Amy, we're almost out of time, but Brattleboro had an interesting vote yesterday banning disposable grocery bags. How did that turn out?
Well, very strong sentiment there that plastic bags should be banned. However, it was an advisory vote. So really, any action is up to the select board. If it wants to write an ordinance banning plastic bags, it can. And it certainly was given that direction by the voters, but they don't have to take them up on that.
So they have the legal authority to do that if they want?
Yeah, many towns have actually banned plastic bags, not necessarily in Vermont, but a lot of coastal towns have. It's a big problem with those lightweight, single-use plastic bags blowing into the ocean. So it can look differently in different towns. Some towns say no plastic bags. Some say no free plastic bags, but you can charge for them. And some say the thicker bags are okay.
Amy Noyes and John Dillon, many thanks for your reports today.
You're welcome,
Bob.
And that's Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow on the program, when controversial author Charles Murray came to speak at Middlebury last week, he was shouted down by protesters. On the next Vermont Edition, we'll talk about what happened in the national debate it's opened up over free speech and campus culture. Send us your questions at vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Many thanks to executive producer Patty Daniels, who made this program happen with all of her hard work. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.